time for another personal finance edition of Focus, and we've got lots of things to talk about. Financial expert Kevin Wasby is back with a look at how our couch potato portfolio did in 2013. And during 2014, what can we expect from the new Federal Reserve Chair, Janet Yellen? Kathy Sweetler of the University of Illinois Extension tells us about a new program that pairs people with financial mentors to help them with money management. Kathy and Kevin both have something to say about the benefits of the earned income tax credit, and they'll drop whatever they're talking about to answer your personal finance questions. I'm Jim Meadows. That's all coming up on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and welcome to our two personal finance experts. They are ready to answer your questions on personal finance issues. Kathy Sweetler is a consumer economics educator with the University of Illinois Extension, and Kevin Wasby is a chartered financial analyst and a lecturer getting ready for another semester at the University of Illinois College of Business. Kevin and Kathy, welcome back to Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thank you, Jim. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, and we welcome your questions on personal finance. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, and you can email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. And you can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Here's a question to ponder for a little later in the program. Is there anybody in your life who's been like a money mentor to you, someone who has told you the facts of life about just the smart things to do financially, just the regular everyday things of managing your money? If someone sticks out in your mind or the lessons that you've learned in life, go ahead and give us a call to talk about that. We're going to be talking about a program that's now available to hook you up with a money mentor if you don't have one already. Kevin, I wanted to look back at 2013, and I thought the one way to do it would be using the regular feature of this program, and that's the David Sinow Couch Potato Portfolio. You've been crunching those numbers all year, an example of investment with minimal effort and thought. How did it work for people who followed that prescription?
2013 was a very rewarding year for people with the couch potato portfolio. And remind our listeners, of course, that these are all no-load index mutual funds that are predominantly invested in stocks. So the stock market itself throughout much of the world, not all of it, but much of the world in 2013 was a very rewarding year. And overall, the couch potato portfolio was roughly 22.5% for a rate of return in 2013.
22.5%.
Correct.
That's certainly a lot more than my savings account was offering in the past year.
Indeed, but certainly with a different level of risk and volatility of those returns.
Now, with this, and it is a low-effort program here, what sort of risk are we talking about? What could happen here?
Well, like any investment in stocks, stock prices drive most of the rate of return that a person receives when they invest in them. So a stock mutual fund then is going to be very susceptible to price changes of those stocks it invests in. Our listeners, I'm sure, can recall years like 2008 when losses of greater than this 22.5% were incurred on these similar types of funds. So, again, never to be compared with anything like your savings account.
This is not a short-term savings thing because essentially what you're saying, if you come across a year like 2008, just wait until things recover, and it will recover, as it certainly did during 2013.
Right. And the other thing that we always think about is this is only a single component. The couch potato portfolio is a single component of hopefully what a person does with their money for all intents and purposes. So there should always be some liquid cash set aside for emergency purposes. these types of things hit to the other end of that extreme, this would be something that you would be investing for over a long period of time, whether it's a retirement purpose or for a very young child's eventual college education. So again, over a longer time frame, 10, 15, 20, even 30 years.
And if you're someone who enjoys or is intrigued by making decisions in the market, you might want to put some of your money into ventures like this, where you don't think about it and you just let it ride, I guess might be the question, and then use a different area of funds to be a little more adventurous with.
Well, and that's one potential. I think Kathy's going to talk a little bit about budgeting here, and here's an element where these two kind of dovetail together. The nice thing about the volatility of things like stock prices fit into a regular purchase program. So in other words, if a person were to use a part of their wealth management strategy in a portfolio like these stock mutual funds, the other thing to remember, aside from just a basic buy and hold and forget strategy, is to look at a regular purchase program. So again, when we begin talking about the overall budgeting process, an important element of that, particularly with volatile price assets like stock mutual funds, is to remind yourself that as you're purchasing new amounts of them each regular period, monthly, quarterly, whatever, that as those prices go lower, you're buying more shares at lower prices. This is the notion that we refer to as dollar cost averaging. Over time, that's a powerful advantage rather than just a buy once and forget and hold strategy.
Okay. The 22% return, besides being nice in itself, is that a reflection about how the market did overall in 2013?
It is, and when we look at the individual components within those eight different stock mutual funds, it's really quite varied. For instance, the return on what you would call large U.S.-based company stocks, the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, was a little over 30% all totaled for the year. But the fund that invests in emerging markets, those countries like Brazil, China, perhaps even Russia, had a negative rate of return, a loss of over 6.5%. And again, that points out kind of the notion of a little bit of diversification, even among a class called stocks, where we don't put all our eggs in one basket.
Okay, so that's part of the idea of the couch potato is that you keep your options open that way.
Right.
Want to move over to, I guess, if we're looking ahead to 2014, you might want to make sure that you're totally equipped with all the financial knowledge you need and maybe also the financial habits you need. And Kathy Sweetler, you were telling us about a program which the U of I Extension is working up, which is one to promote financial literacy and really is some of the basics for that somebody to anybody at life could need, but it's more than just, say, going to a class on financial literacy.
That's right. We have a new program, University of Illinois Extension, called Money Mentors, which started up late in 2013, and we're really getting rolling now. And it came about that we decided to do this program because we really saw a need in the community. I was hearing from people that they were looking for something that went beyond a workshop or two on money management, that they were looking for individual help on trying to, you know, take that next step and get their finances in order to work towards their own financial goals, whether they were, you know, tracking their spending or spending down, you know, paying down debt or saving for goals, building up some money so they could start investing. And they were asking me, how can I get this help? How can I get the individual help I need?
And where do you go? I mean, some people might go to someone like Kevin and pay Kevin a good commission on that.
That's right. Somebody might. And we're not doing the types of things that most financial professionals would be helping people do. So when somebody is looking at, you know, what Kevin was talking about building a investment portfolio that's diversified, that you can feel comfortable with, that is really we'll be referring people to consult with a financial professional that can sit down and look at all those different variables and what makes sense for them.
You're talking more about the everyday sort of kitchen table financial decisions.
That's right. So for a lot of people, myself included, probably the last thing I feel like doing on the weekend is sitting down and organizing my finances and figuring out what my goals are, and is my money going towards those goals or is it going towards who knows what? And so having somebody there that can be a mentor that can say, okay, what do you want to do? Well, you say you want to know where your money's going, then you're going to need to track it. And then we can look at it and we can figure out, is this how you want it or what changes do you want to make? You say you're having trouble paying your bills on time. Let's look at a money management calendar. That might be a system that would work well for you. If not, let's look at a different system and see what would work well for you.
So this is where essentially to take part in this, they would contact the extension about the Money Mentor program?
That's right. So we have information up on our website, which you can read more about it, or you can give my colleague Kayla Waters a phone call at 217-442-8615.
That's 217-442-8615. And at this point, I can tell you that you can go to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus, and you'll find a link to a page about the Money Mentors program.
Well, that's wonderful.
And we have somebody on the phone now, one of the Money Mentors.
Wonderful.
These are volunteers, right?
This is a volunteer-based program.
Well, on line four, I want to say hello. I'm sorry, I don't know your name, but I understand you're a volunteer money mentor for the U of I Extension.
Yes. My name is Jim Phillips.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for being on the program today. And am I correct in thinking you probably know Kathy Sweetler?
Yes, I do.
How did you get started in being, in volunteering this way?
This is the second iteration of the program. So there was an earlier one that I had been involved with. And the way I got involved with that is there was actually a short article in the paper mentioning that this was coming, that there was training coming up, and I had sort of been, looking for a volunteer opportunity that sort of fit what I was interested in, and this sounded like exactly the kind of thing that I'm interested in doing because, I sort of enjoy learning about personal finance. I have, an interest in that area and also an interest in sort of, helping people and helping people, maybe change their behavior or teach them some of the things that I learned growing up from my parents that maybe they didn't learn.
So were you in any way a financial professional going into this, or was it all just from your own regular experience and the training you received to be a mentor? Yeah.
I am in no way a financial professional. All I can say is that I had a very good luck with who my parents were.
And what was the training like? What did they tell you? What did they tell you about there?
So the training this time was very good. So, you would sort of worry that you're going to go in and you would get a lot of presentations on things that you already know. So this is how you make a budget and the kinds of things you're supposed to be helping with. The nice thing about the training was that Kathy gave us sort of readings to do to sort of brush up on those types of things that, most of the people volunteering as mentors would already be familiar with. And then we talked about things like, different personality types. So, the people that you may be helping are going to be different than you. Some of them will think in, completely different ways. You may be a number person. They're more of a feelings person. And, this is how people's behavior changes over time. This is, good ways to help someone to improve their behavior rather than just knowing this is what, they should be doing. These are the straight techniques.
It's interesting you brought that issue about changing behavior because I was reading a magazine article that was critical of other types of financial literacy courses. They didn't get into mentors. But it seems to be that the author's main point was that a lot of financial literacy courses assume that everybody is going to be a rational actor all the time, and it's no problem. But we're just not built like that, I take it. So we have to be more careful.
Well, yes, people are human. And, so I was listening to the Couch Potato portfolio discussion, and, that is exactly the right strategy. You want to invest for the long haul, leave the money in. The problem is that okay, you hit a year where stocks drop by 50%, the right thing to do is not panic. What people tend to do is, oh my God, it's dropped by half, it could drop the rest of the way, I'd better sell out at the bottom, and they lose a lot of money. So yeah, it's very much controlling your own behavior.
What has it been like working with people as a money mentor?
It's been rewarding. So when I was in the program before, I met with, I think there were two different people. One was an older couple that I met with for a couple of months, and one was a younger woman who really just, you know, had some questions, and it varies quite a bit. My approach was, you know, basically listen and try to be, you know, an outside observer and a disinterested party and say, like, okay, so what changes are you trying to make? What problems are you addressing? And then how can I suggest, well, you know, have you thought about it this way? Maybe you might want to try this strategy. You know, if you're having, you know, trouble saving, maybe pay yourself first. Okay, you know, keep track of what you're spending. Okay, let's go over that. And, you know, the nice thing is that this, you know, relationship will stretch out for a couple of months. So you can actually see, okay, you know, have they made changes? Are they making progress? Do we need to try something different? But in one case, you know, the person came in and she was like, okay, you know, how do I keep a budget and, you know, keep track of all of these things? There are these different forms. And in fact, you know, she was doing fine. She was keeping track of all of her expenses. She was managing everything. She was just worried that there was some, you know, specific proper way that she was supposed to do this.
And there's no specific proper way, I take it.
There is not. I mean, people have different personalities, so what works for someone who loves spreadsheets is not going to work for someone who likes to sit under trees and look at flowers necessarily.
What is the sit under trees, look at flowers alternative to a spreadsheet in order to keep track of your finances?
Well, so that's the question. I mean, my personal strategies, I know a lot of people do not have detailed budgets for what they want to spend on what. You know, what works for me is, you know, I have savings coming out of every paycheck. And in theory, if, you know, if you pay yourself first and save, as long as you have, you know, you can spend all your money every month and you will still be building up savings because you're paying yourself first. And for people who don't want to do a lot of planning, that's a good way to do it. When I was a student, I think one of the things that I looked at, and this is just the way I think, is like, hey, if I keep a minimum balance in my checking account, first of all, I'm not paying, you know, $10 a month or whatever in fees for that. And second of all, I'm much less likely to have a check bounce just by having that system. And if you do those big things right, you know, if you go out to eat a little bit more or, you know, you buy clothes, you will naturally take the money out of something else.
Okay. But the savings will be protected.
Right. So it's a lot of personal change is simply developing good habits. So, you know, most of the things we do in a day, we don't think about. You know, I can drive to work and have no idea how I got there because I know how to do that. If you develop a habit where, you know, every afternoon you go out and spend $10 on, you know, a latte and a donut, you know, A, that's not good for your waistline and it's probably not good for your budget. If you can break that habit, and then, you know, just go get a glass of water and walk around the block. You only, you know, breaking a habit is hard, but once you have a good habit established, then you don't have to think about that. And then you can think about, well, what else can I maybe change?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, sorry, please.
I'm wondering if, you know, one of the challenges for some people who might seek a money mentor is to make sure that they are not casually running up debt, and that's just using a credit card and paying off the minimum instead of going to another category, budgetary funds, to say buy that donut. And How do you work with changing habits in situations like that?
So, I mean, some of the things that we know about habits is that, you know, habits have triggers. So the question, you know, in some cases is, okay, why are you going out? You know, what triggers you to go and put something on your credit card? Is it retail therapy where, you know, you go shopping, you see something, you buy it? You know, is the trick don't go shopping? There is the strategy that, you know, a lot of people say is, okay, we'll take the credit card and we'll freeze it in a block of ice in the freezer so that it is, you know, physically hard to go out and, you know, actually spend money on it. But yeah, I mean, the other thing that you can do is some people care more about the future. You can try and point out that, look, if you keep making this minimum payment, you're going to be doing this forever. The other issue is that, you know, people will look at different numbers. So when I have a credit card, my goal is, okay, I want to pay this off at the end of every month and not pay interest. So I'm anchoring on that zero balance after I pay it off. Some people, they see the big number that's the minimum payment, and they think, okay, that's what I'm supposed to do because that's what their habit is. If you can get them to change that and explain, look, you know, you're going to make a pretty good return on anything you put to pay down your credit card debt, you know, that 22% return that was a great year for the portfolio, you know, paying down credit card debt will pretty much give you a 22% return with zero risk, which is way better than the stock market.
Now, I'm wondering is your relationship with the people that you mentor, how long does it last, and how do you know when it's over?
Well, it's designed to last. I think Kathy might correct me on this. Maybe 6 months, I would say, at the outside. This is not supposed to be a long-term relationship, but it's supposed to be long enough that you can actually see people developing good habits and making progress and learning things. So you will generally have, you know, the first meeting, you just talk. You want to find out where they're at, where, you know, what the issues are that they are interested and willing and ready to address. And then, you know, what can we ask someone to do to address that? And then, you know, you would have a meeting maybe every other week or at first, and then, you know, maybe once a month for a few months after that, just to check progress, see how the system is working, and make progress. But at that point, you know, if some point they're probably going to feel like they are not, you know, getting as much out. So if you talk to someone and they're doing fine and they've made progress and they can continue on their own, that's great. You say, okay, we can, you know, here are some other resources. You know, you can always contact me by, you know, phone or email if you have any specific questions, but we don't have to have these regular meetings. And then, you know, we let Kathy know how things have gone and that we've wrapped up and that we're ready for someone else. Or sometimes, you know, there's just nothing changing and you might have to let it go. And, you know, sometimes, like any relationship, people will just sort of fade away or something else will come up, and we're not going to, you know, chase them down like a collection agency to make them meet with us.
Okay. Well, Jim, this really does sound like a program with a lot of potential for people who just need that sort of one-on-one attention so they can look at their financial life in detail and their financial habits.
Mm-hmm. And one of the wonderful things I do want to point out is that there is a wide variety of mentors. So, you know, my approach is going to be different from everyone else's approach. My life experience is very different than the other mentors in the program. And, you know, Kathy can do a great job of actually matching up people with appropriate partners and mentors in this process.
Well, Jim Phillips, I want to thank you for talking with us today on Focus about the Money Mentor Program and being a money mentor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care. And let's talk again about the particulars about this. This is only available in part of Illinois. I understand it's Champaign, Ford, Iroquois, and Vermilion counties, and you're moving into McLean this spring?
That's right. I have a colleague, another consumer economics educator, Pam Atkins, who works over in the McLean County Extension Office, and she'll be starting up this program this spring.
Well, go ahead and look at our website. Go to will.illinois.edu/focus, and you will find a link to the Money Mentors page over at the U of I Extension with all the information about the Money Mentor program. You'll also find the latest on the David Sinnell Couch Potato Portfolio that we were talking about earlier. This is Focus at WILL. We're going to take a break now, but we will continue with personal finance advice with Kevin Waspy and Kathy Sweetler. We have a caller waiting on the line, and we will get to him right after this break. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. My guests today are Kathy Sweetler, consumer economics educator with the University of Illinois Extension, and Kevin Waspy, chartered financial analyst and a lecturer at the University of Illinois College of Business. They're here to answer your personal finance questions. It's a program we try to do every month or so, usually on a Friday, and we welcome your questions on saving, investing, anything about personal finances. Call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Let's go now to line one. Dave in Champaign, good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, I'm wondering if you do anything similar for nonprofits. Let me say that often a nonprofit starts with a donut and a cup of coffee in the basement with two other people. So we don't have the skills that are necessary for a lot of these things. Instance, the fact that we worked with the early establishment of a trail between Urbana and Danville. And now that's got to be a multi-million-dollar thing. But we're still left with some of the elements of working with the primitive start of this sort of thing. Do you work with nonprofits? I know that the Arts Council has a problem with artists often because they're not, they're almost sitting out there with the daisies dreaming rather than doing this sort of thing. We don't know the banking regulations, a whole bunch of things we don't know about. So, yeah, do you work with nonprofits?
Hi, Dave. No, actually, that would not be my area of expertise, and we aren't set up to do that. But I might suggest that you contact the Illinois Small Business Development Center, and they might be who you'll be looking for that would be able to help you out.
That's the Illinois Small Business Development Center. Where do you find them?
I just follow them on the website. but the phone number they're showing here is 217-359-6261. And I know that they offer courses for startups about kind of like how to get your finances in order. What are you trying to do? What's your financial plan for your business?
And that's for, do you think they could help small nonprofit organizations the same way as a small business?
I would think that a lot of the principles would be similar. But, and if not, they might know who to refer you to.
Okay. Dave, I hope that helps. I guess there are questions there if anybody else has some ideas of where a nonprofit organization might want to get started to make sure that they're financially sound. Go ahead and call into the program and let us know what you've found out at 1-800-222-9455. Dave, thank you for the call. And that is a question, I guess, because nonprofit organizations can really start with a few people, just like a small business. They can start with somebody who has a passion for something and getting something done. But then they realized, oh, my gosh, we're actually talking about real money and organization and all sorts of things they hadn't thought about when they were just when it was just a dream. But you got to start somewhere.
You got to start somewhere. But then there does come a point where you have to look at sort of, you know, cash flow and how you want your monies to be going and what are your goals. So in a lot, you know, I think some of that thought process would be is similar, as he said, to your personal finances as well as starting up businesses.
Well, I was, you know, looking at this Money Mentor program that you're working with here at the Extension, and I was wondering if either you or Kevin ever had the equivalent in your life? Was there ever any somebody in your life who gave you sound financial advice that you depended on that made a difference? Was it something that you were fortunate enough to be paying attention when your parents told you about it, or did it happen somewhere else in life?
I mean, I think for myself, you know, one thing is that financial education has been sort of a lifetime of learning, that you learn different things at different phases of your life. So I think, you know, my parents were good mentors. They owned their own business. I think I learned very early that you're going to work really long hours if you own your own business. And they were frugal in their spending. I had two grandmas. They had very different spending patterns. And I think just by observing them, I learned things too. So, you know, and then I remember even when we went out, you know, when I was in college, I thought, well, now's a good time to take a class on investing. I had no money to invest, but it just seemed like a good idea. And of course, I went on to do master's work in financial education too. But more of the life experiences that you get to a point where you say, well, I'd like to think about buying a house. Well, I don't know anything about buying a house. What do I need to know? Where do I get that information? How do I search it out?
So sometimes it's when you need to know that you're really ready to pay attention about it.
That's right. I think it has to be timely.
Kevin, what about you? Your business is financial advice. When did you first start learning about it yourself?
Well, that's true and not true. My business now is basically financial education.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just quickly go through a background. Like Kathy, I was lucky. I grew up in a family that was, tight. If frugal is the word we could
knew
use.
The value of a dollar?
Well, could squeeze a dollar and get five nickels plus four quarters to fall out of it. You know, it was... It's like any other habit we form in our lifetime. It's usually influenced by the behavior of others. If we're around others that have certain behavior or certain characteristics, then more likely than not, we're going to find ourselves with similar behaviors. That's not true for everyone, but it's certainly more true than not true. What I like to tell students in the classroom is the purpose of education is not to learn something, but it's to learn how to learn. So back to what Kathy just said a moment ago, a person may do a lot of different things throughout the course of their lifetime, including financial things such as buying a house. Is it necessary for them to know everything about buying a house from the time they're 18, 21, 26, 30, you know, at some age? And the answer is no. The important thing about learning is if we know how to learn when we need to learn, then when it's appropriate for us to learn how to buy a house, we can do that efficiently and we can do that effectively and make good decisions as opposed to poor decisions. That same thing translates into basic saving and spending habits. So I think it's very appropriate for a person, even at the age of 5, 6, 7 years old, to begin to think about those types of habits that will influence their financial health for the rest of their lives. Just like it's important for a person at 4, 5, 6 years old to begin to learn about nutritional habits and how those habits will influence their health for the rest of their lives. So again, learning how to learn, this is the business of education.
Okay. And you're working with, you know, you're working with college students at the U of I College of Business. Sometimes I'm wondering, I think it's possible to get a business degree and maybe still have some weak point when it comes to personal money management.
Oh, absolutely. There's the discipline of business, whether it's, finance, accountancy, business administration, whatever, much of that is going to be complementary to good personal finance habits, obviously, but the two don't have to be exactly linked.
Sometimes people are better in one area than the other.
Well, we do find business people making some imprudent decisions personally. Mm-hmm. That's not impossible. So, yeah, good habits, you know, good life habits are good reinforcements to good success throughout any of our endeavors. Highly correlated, perhaps not perfectly required.
Well, we are talking about personal finance here on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guests are Kevin Wasby and also Kathy Sweetler with the U of I Extension. There's one thing I wanted to make sure that we talked about, and we were talking about this a little bit before on air, is a program that can be useful for a lot of working households, the Earned Income Tax Credit. And maybe this is something as tax time rolls around and people are starting to collect their forms. Is this the sort of program that you use when you're filing your taxes?
That's right. So the Earned Income Tax Credit is something that you would be filing for when you filed for your regular, you know, you're filing your taxes, both federal and state. And it is set up by the government as a benefit for people who are working. You need to have earned income. And it's a way of reducing the amount of tax you owe. And you may even get a refund from it. So if you don't owe quite as much as your tax credit, then you would get that money back. And so it's designed to really help people who are low to moderate income with their finances. And it's your right to have it. And we just want to make sure that everybody knows that it's out there and that they can be applying for it.
And this is something that could help people whose maybe income is quite low, that they may not think of themselves as someone who has to pay taxes.
Well, that's right, because if you qualify and but yet your income, you don't have to be paying taxes, you can still get this tax credit and you'll receive money from the government, which is kind of a nice scenario.
How does it work? I mean, are there particular steps just for signing up for it?
There's a particular form that you have to fill out, just like when you're filling out all the other forms. But you just have to keep in mind that you have to have earned income. So it has to be something where you've been working for it, not like receiving just Social Security benefits or something like that.
Oh, and also, if you're living off interest income, that would not qualify.
You cannot be a qualifying child on somebody else's return. So let's say that your parents are taking you as a dependent still, then you can't be getting it. And you have to be between the ages of 25 and 65.
Okay.
So those are beyond that, you probably would, if that sounds like you're still fitting into that categories, then you'd want to look it up and run through the steps to see if you would qualify and how much you would receive from this credit.
And you should note there's an earned income tax credit for your federal taxes. And also in Illinois, there's an earned income tax credit for your Illinois income tax.
That's right. So if you qualify for the federal, make sure you also ask for it from the Illinois.
How much of a difference can this make for people?
The maximum amount that you could get back if you qualified, had the right number of children, the right income level, would be over $6,000 this year.
So other people, even if they don't get the maximum, might get several hundred, maybe
that's
a thousand or so
dollars.
That's
right. If you have no qualifying children but your income qualifies you, then you would receive about just under $500.
The fact that we're talking about this makes me think that this is not a universally known program. It's out there. It's been out there for a few years, hasn't it?
Well, it's been out there for a long time. It's really kind of a trigger type event for the lack of a better way to describe it. When a person fills out their tax return for the year and carefully reads the instructions, and that I know is onerous, but as you complete your return and you get to a certain line on the 1040, you're literally prompted to say that if that amount is less than a certain amount, based on number of children, so on and so forth, then you may qualify for. So then, again, with the paper forms, you would look at the instructions for what form you are indicated to, reference, and then that will tell you how much you're eligible to receive back. It's an attachment to your filing, so on and so forth. In today's day and age, when many people do their income tax using a software program, so whether it's TurboTax or anything else, as you enter the information, the software checks to see, based on the information you've entered, whether or not you're going to be eligible for this tax credit. So much like our tax code, it's very cumbersome. It's Byzantine. But if you're using a tax software preparation program or a tax service in person to do your income tax, these things are pretty automatically, triggered.
Okay. So there is that advantage these days if you're using things like tax software or a program online, then it will probably spot whether you qualify or not.
Right.
But it sounds like a wise thing if you're just filling out a form. I remember filling out tax forms. Yes, it has changed in the last few years. You just want to remember that if you're prompted with that opportunity, it's a good opportunity to take.
That's right. So anyone with earnings under $51,000, about $500, should really be checking to see if they qualify. That just kind of gives you a guideline to be looking. And sometimes when we're going through these forms or these online things, if something comes up that you're not clear about or unaware, you may just pass it by thinking, oh, I don't want to cause any problem. I'm not going to do that one. But really, if it says tax credit, take a look at it, because those are ones that can really help you out.
Another thing to remind yourself of is also, if this is if hearing this is kind of prompting a thought in your mind saying, oh, my goodness, I didn't do that or I didn't check closely enough last year, not to worry. This year, when you do your income tax or go to a tax preparatory service, you can literally look back at the past 3 years of your tax filings. And if you were eligible but just, omitted or skipped over it or whatever, you can apply on this year and get that back retroactively. So it's nothing that's, gone forever.
So you have 3 years back that you can take advantage of if you haven't done so already. Just letting you know, there's still time for your personal finance questions for Kevin Wasby and Kathy Sweetler here on Focus on WILL. Our phone number, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. And we have another caller on line one. This is Sarah from Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I want to know, we were discussing this morning over coffee after our little exercise group, how do you protect yourself against identity theft? When you put your money, you use your debit card, then they steal it. What are you liable for? I know your credit card, they absorb most of that, but what if they get into your checking account and your savings account because they're all in the same bank? You know what I mean.
Right, right. That's a very timely question, especially with the 70-plus million people whose financial transactions have been compromised over the past couple of months at a variety of large retailers. I guess I'm going to express a bias first, and then we can talk about the remedies later. In today's electronic world, there are great conveniences, but I think in logic, if you think about this in anything, along with every convenience comes a cost, whether it's hidden or obvious. So we have a great convenience to carry a piece of plastic that accesses our checking account or perhaps even savings account, as opposed to writing a piece of paper that we used to call a check. I don't use a debit card. There's my bias.
You would not use a debit card. And it was interesting because I think the whole idea of debit cards was a way to spend your money and not money you did not have and not run up debt.
Right. And now let's go back to an earlier discussion about habits. I'm frugal. I'm cheap. I don't like to spend my money. So generally speaking, what I have in my wallet is cash, which is my money, and a credit card. And if I choose to spend the cash to do, today I'm meeting some colleagues for lunch, so I'll pull some cash out of my pocket because I'm going to buy, heaven forbid, maybe a fish sandwich and a beer. and I'm going to pay for that with cash. If I go to the gas station, though, and I fill up my car with gas, I'm going to pull out my credit card. And the reason I'll do that is because at the end of the month, I'm going to pay off the entire balance on my credit card, including that $75 or $80 that it cost me to fill up my gas tank. I'm using somebody else's money for free for 28 days. Now, that's, again, going back to an earlier part of our discussion, that has to do with a little bit of habits, a little bit of pay yourself first mentality, a little bit about let me use somebody else's money and do it in a way that doesn't cost me anything. On a credit card, I know if my information is stolen, that under law, the maximum amount of loss to me, the person carrying the card, is $50. I'm not so sure about that as it relates to debit cards. I think the same law is closely applied, but not strictly applied.
Kathy is shaking her head. Kathy Sweetler, what's up?
So I have to start. So a couple things here. One is, unfortunately, we don't have the same protections by law for debit cards that we do for credit cards. So Kevin's absolutely right. The amount you can stand to lose on a credit card is $50 if somebody steals your identity, and typically the credit card companies back you and you're not responsible for that. On a debit card, we don't have that protection. If you know that somebody steals your wallet and you report it within 2 days, then you're protected up to that $50. But many times, these identity theft situations, we still have our card and we don't know that somebody else is using it. And you could be liable up to the full amount in that account. And so the security is much, in terms of identity theft, is much riskier with a debit card. There's also risk with carrying cash. And so that's something else that people have to balance. I think with a lot of these financial tools, we're balancing what are our risks? Are we going to be, is it comfortable for us to put things on a credit card and know that we'll be able to pay it off at the end of the month? Or do we stand the risk that that won't happen and we're going to end up with high interest charges? Are we comfortable in our environment with carrying cash? Or do we want to use these different tools and kind of minimize our risk, like have our debit cards only hooked to an account that doesn't have a lot of money in it, that we have a cash account for spending, we have an account for our savings where more of our money is, and don't put your debit card attached to that one. So then you minimize your risk there. Can you set up text alerts on your the checking account or the account that your debit card's attached to so that as money comes in and out, you get a little text alert on your phone? We found that that has reduced identity theft in a really significant manner, because instead of people waiting to get their statement every 30 days, they're checking their accounts regularly using their phones. With these text alerts, they can stop that identity theft right away. The other thing I would really suggest to people is that if you haven't done it recently, check your credit report. That's the best way for us to protect against identity theft. You can check your credit report for free at all three credit bureaus at annualcreditreport.com.
So that you, if you have a large amount in your checking account, because your paycheck goes in there, for example, you know, automatically, so you should take that money and put it in a savings account that will protect you from being able for them to get to that savings account, even though it's in the same bank.
Yes, that's a good suggestion, and let me even use what you've just said, but turn it upside down. I want to go back to what Jim Phillips, a phrase he used earlier in the show, pay yourself first. So my paycheck, my payroll deposit every 15th of the month goes into my savings account, not my checking account. See, right there I'm telling myself I'm paying myself first. I have to physically transfer money from my savings account to my checking account when I write a check, or if I use some form of electronic payment to pay a bill that takes that money from my checking account. That's one of the tools that I use to budget myself. And it also, if I were to carry a debit card, limits my, how should we say, exposure to loss to the amount of money in my checking account.
I would also second, though, if you're comfortable knowing that you can pay off your credit card at the end of the month, using a credit card versus a debit card is a more secure manner. Everybody has to balance out what's the best way for them. I use my credit card a lot more than I use my debit card.
And we are just about running out of time. I want to apologize to the caller waiting on the line. If you want to still wait, perhaps Kevin can talk to that caller off the air and get their question.
Well, don't exclude Kathy.
Or Kathy, for that matter. Let's see which ones has the best answer. Or you can take your pick of both of them. This wraps up another program on personal finance. Kevin Wasby and Kathy Sweetler, thank you for being on Focus today, answering our listeners' questions and giving the financial advice, talking about the money mentoring program and finances in general. Kevin Wasby is a chartered financial analyst and a lecturer at the U of I College of Business. Kathy Sweetler is a consumer economics educator with the U of I Extension. And thanks to everyone who sent in their questions. Our apologies to anyone who didn't make it on the air. We invite you to continue the discussion on today's program at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Mike Pritchard is our technical director today. Focus is taking Monday off to observe the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. In this time slot on Monday, you'll hear a special program from State of the Reunion from that particular public radio series called Redefining Black History, presenting some alternative narratives in African American history that go beyond the usual accounts that are told this time of year. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear us on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WYLL.